Your Excellency, Mr. João Rebelo, President of the Portuguese Atlantic Committee, Your Excellency, Mr. Paulo Portas, Your Excellency, Mr. Miguel Ferreira da Silva, dear participants, dear guests, dear friends, thank you so much for being here with us once again in our 25th edition of our Portuguese Atlantic Youth Seminar, organized by the Portuguese Atlantic Committee and also by IATA Portugal, the Youth Atlantic Treaty Association of Portugal. Here we are at the House of Democracy in Portugal. We hope you have enjoyed this visit. I'm sure you do. You did. I can't avoid saying that my first time here in the Portuguese Parliament was when I was 14, 15 years old, in a remarkable initiative promoted by the Portuguese Parliament, the Youth Parliament. And I can remember those days full of teenagers and young people, full of expectations, full of dreams to create a better Portugal and a better world. And allow me to tell you that we have today two guests with us, our renowned speakers, who I truly believe that contributed and continue to contribute to a better world and to a better Portugal, Mr. Paulo Portas and Mr. Miguel Ferreira da Silva. Allow me to introduce them. His Excellency Mr. Paulo Portas served as Portugal Minister of Foreign Affairs and Deputy Prime Minister, responsible for economic coordination, investment and exports between 2011 and 2015. Paulo Portas served also as Minister of Defence from 2002 to 2005. He was leader of the centre-right Portuguese party, CDS-PP, for 16 years, eight of them while in government. Paulo Portas was Member of Parliament for eight terms. He is graduated in law by Catholic University of Lisbon and taught history of political thought. He teaches geoeconomics in international relations in Nova University in Portugal, Emirates Diplomatic Academy in Abu Dhabi, and directs seminars on economic diplomacy for multinational corporations. In 2016, he withdrew from party politics and is back to private sector. He became chairman of International Strategic Council of Mota Engil, the largest Portuguese infrastructure company for Latin America and Africa. Also member of the International Board of Pemex Gas in Mexico and deputy chairman of the Portuguese Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Founding partner of Vinciamo Consulting, strategic analysis and business intelligence, focusing in advising business internationalization in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. He is also a regular commentator of international politics in the leading Portugal TV and frequent speaker in international conferences. Mr. Paulo Portas, thank you so much once again for being with us, and if you allow me, for being a friend of the Portuguese Atlantic Committee and IATA Portugal. Thank you. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody, to the Portuguese former Senate room. I want to thank the invitation to your youth president and your former youth president, João Rebelo. He's a former MP of the Portuguese Parliament, and I specialized on defense. He was and he is one of the former MPs with more knowledge and experience on security and defense. I also want to share my pleasure to be in this panel talking to sharing opinions with a youth pro-Atlantic organization. If there is a moment to remember how relevant NATO is, this is the moment. Never forget that under your grandfathers and fathers' generation, NATO won the Cold War without firing a shot, a single one, just because NATO was strong. Strong enough to be dissuasive of a conflict. And I will be back to this idea. You probably remember, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, the President of the French Republic, Emmanuel Macron, said NATO is suffering brain death. You should not be definitive on your political opinions, because reality can trouble your opinions. And no, there was a lot of controversy about the future of NATO, but the basics of NATO are stronger than ever, I would say. This is the strongest moment of NATO after the end of Cold War. And NATO is, for the moment, the collective security organization with a best rate of success. I underline, democracies won the Cold War with NATO. And we could have lost it without NATO. This NATO revival is not due to a good reason, as we all know. So the first thing I want to share with you, with zero ambiguity, words are relevant in decisive moments. And I have no ambiguity about what happened in Ukraine. It's the war caused by Russia invading Ukraine. I don't love the wording war in Ukraine. No. There is not similarity or parallels between aggressor and invader. And this is this the revival of NATO, the wake up of many Europeans about the relevance of NATO is directly linked with what happened in Ukraine last February 24. I mean the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And you can just, to put it in context, you have five axes where NATO is becoming more relevant than many thought in Europe. One, the transatlantic relation between the United States and Europe is in a much better shape than 5 years ago. I know 5 years seems eternity, okay, in this digital society where you don't have long-term or memory. You just have present. But remember how was the relation between Europe and United States of America in the beginning of the Donald Trump term. It was an isolationist term. He was skeptical about NATO, and the relation with Europe was sufficiently bad. We are now living a much better moment. United States is back on its foreign policy to a multilateral approach. And I know you are very young, and probably sometimes you think Joe Biden is too old. The same age of a great president, Ronald Reagan. But he's trying to restore the critical alliances of the United States. And the critical alliances of the United States are Europe and democracies in Asia. Those are the critical alliances that, unhappily, the isolationist experience of the precedent 4 years left alone frequently, namely in Asia. China occupied a lot of room of maneuver and space when the United States withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Agreement. And if I may suggest you a lesson on globalization, there are no empty spaces in a global world. If you withdraw from your position, someone will pick your position. It happened in Asia, namely. Okay, so the first thing is that improved a lot is the relation between the United States and Europe. The second one, we Europeans, I'm now sharing this opinion mainly for Europeans, we should be aware that more than 100,000 American soldiers are in Europe, standing in Europe for our security. We don't have 100,000 Europeans in US fighting for the US security. Remember that. Now more than 100,000 American soldiers are, namely, but not only, in the eastern border of Europe. And we cannot for the moment, maybe in the long term, things would be different. I'm strongly against duplications, but the critical pillars of the European security are strongly linked with the American and European alliance. This is the second idea I want to share with you. The third one, we are obliged to strengthen seriously our security on the eastern border of Europe, not forgetting some threats we have to face in the south. But as you know, before the invasion of Ukraine, Russia had already a considerable number of borders with NATO countries, sometimes NATO and EU countries. You had borders with Norway, with Finland, not NATO at the moment, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland. I'm just considering land borders. And then after the invasion of Ukraine, we are risking to have Russia, if they fulfill their goals, with more four borders, three of them directly with EU and NATO. Hungary, Slovakia, and Romania. And you have to add Moldova, which is a candidate. And then you have the critical maritime border with Turkey, a critical member of NATO, and one of the bridges between two worlds. So we have no alternative except reinforce and strengthen our eastern security, because we have bombs 70 kilometers away from European border. The fourth reason of this change and this revival of NATO is the Nordic accession to NATO. Nordics were always pro-Atlanticists, but Sweden and Finland were not NATO members. Denmark and Norway were NATO members. One of my best colleagues when I was defense minister was a remarkable lady that was Minister of Defense of Norway, for instance. Now, one of the setbacks of the invasion of Ukraine that maybe one of these days Mr. Putin will think about it, you will have more NATO with more members, with more budget, with more weapons. Because everybody understood that we cannot take for granted that Ukraine is the last step. If he wins, it will not be the last step. So The fifth reason I want to share with you is finally Europeans understood that the commitment since, if I remember well, the Glasgow summit, so 2014,
Wales.
Hmm? In Wales, not Glasgow, you're right. You know how he's very good. The Wales summit, finally Europeans in Madrid committed globally with the 2% of investment on defense and security. And now you had last year you had just 9 countries with 2%. 9. With the change of the Ukraine invasion and the wake up of the security question in Europe, you will have 19 in the end of 2024. And then you will have 5 more till 2030. You are very close to a global and coherent and shared commitment on defense and security. And you know, in my opinion, these 5 reasons are relevant, but the most relevant one is none of these 5. What is the big change for me? Finally, Europeans maybe understood there is no such a thing as peace without defense. Sorry to be so frank. I would say almost half of the Europeans were convinced that peace is a gift and you don't have to fight for peace. You can take it for granted. Would Mr. Putin take it for granted? There is no such a thing as peace without defense. You need defense to have peace. And one of the incentives that, in my opinion, guided Mr. Putin was the lack of defense on Europe. He knew 2 things. None American president, nor Democrat or Republican, would fight directly a war abroad. Remember, one of the few things the 2 candidates to President of the United States agreed was, I want my soldiers back. So he knew that United States wouldn't fight directly. Probably he underestimated the capacity of the Americans to finance and stand for Ukraine in an indirect way. And the other reason that was an incentive for Mr. Putin is he was absolutely sure that Europe wouldn't fight. So those are the changes. If this seminar occurred in Lisbon 6 months ago, probably our discussions would be completely different. So on the second remark I want to share with you, it's about what can you find in common. That was more or less the epigraph of the title of this panel. COVID, Ukraine, biological weapons, biological research. Let me put the things in underline some remarks. COVID and Ukraine are completely different phenomena. And don't try to be too much imaginative. It's different. But there are some lessons in common. And I would focus on these lessons. Both phenomena, both COVID and Ukraine, have global consequences. But these consequences are not symmetric. One thing is to be to have a global crisis. The other one is to have a symmetric crisis all around the world. Remember what happened with the economic recovery after the toughest moment of COVID. Assuming we are in the path to an endemic situation. If you consider 2019 our last happy year without abnormal phenomena, okay, disruptive phenomena, China just needed less than 1 year to recover the base 100 on economics, the base of 2019. United States needed 1.5 years. They recovered the level of 2019 last year. Europe, with some exceptions, the most remarkable and notable, Ireland, Europe as a group needed 2 years to 2.5 years to recover from 2019. I mean, COVID was global, but not exactly equally global everywhere. And the same thing about Ukraine. What are the, nobody knows the answer to the $1 billion question, how long this war will last. But what you can forecast, assuming the current forecasts, the economic consequences of this war for the three major blocs are completely different. Europe is obviously the most severely impacted economic bloc with this war. Then the United States. And in the last position, less impacted, China. And the difference between the three blocs, it's not geography, not only geography. Geography is very relevant. But the difference, it's energy. Europe is energetically dependent. United States are net exporters of energy. And China is buying energy at a cheaper price. And energetic assets in Russia. Both phenomena were global, but they were not symmetric. There is another, and in my opinion, and I think it's your largest interest to debate, both crises showed in a dramatic way the lack of a strong international system in our lives and days. Okay? Both COVID and Ukraine are showing the weaknesses of our international order. I don't love too much the wording international order because the ambition is enormous. But I have a modest ambition. As a European citizen and a Western believer, I would love to have a decent international crisis management system. So my ambition is not a new international order. I don't trust too much in utopia. My ambition is to have a safe and effective and dissuasive international management crisis system. What happened with COVID? The natural instinct, protectionist, isolationist, close borders, fire foreigners. Close, close, close. We needed much more international cooperation. And just think a little bit how many international organizations were relevant during the COVID crisis. NATO was not very relevant because it was not the core. It was not the core of NATO mission. But The Security Council of United Nations was zero during the COVID crisis. World Trade Organization should be relevant, could have been very relevant to avoid dramatic fall of international markets, but it was deadlocked. The only two organizations relevant during COVID crisis were WHO and European Union on different levels. WHO has a lot of limits. You can, I know all the critics that common critics, common wisdom criticism towards WHO. Anyway, I prefer a world with WHO with limits than a world without WHO. Okay? Don't forget, on pandemics and endemics, WHO is the universal memory of all pandemics and experiences and researches. We don't have another one. When you have to benchmark, the address is WHO. European Union had no experience on health. It was marginal. And it was a work in progress. And it was a success, a relative success, the common purchase of vaccines and trying to establish some common guidelines on the vaccination, at least. But if you consider other organizations, they were absolutely irrelevant. Consider now war in Ukraine. NATO is very relevant, extremely relevant. Maybe G20, which is not a permanent organization, can be relevant. And you know why? Because of stress debt problems in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. Maybe the financial guidelines of G20 will help many nations to survive some financial stresses with this war. You have one organization of the United Nations system that is relevant, which is the Agriculture and Food Organization. And it's very relevant for the Southern Hemisphere. The Security Council is again zero. And finally, last Friday, United Nations was at least relevant in the building, not so relevant than Turkey, which was the mediator, but as an assistant mediator with experience in international negotiations, United Nations were relevant on the possible agreement to free the navigation in the Black Sea and to free the exports of cereals to the Southern Hemisphere, namely, not only, but namely, okay? So, if we consider our international order is sufficiently strong to deal with conflicts like Ukraine or threats like a pandemic, no. We had two wars in 3 years. Do you think we are going to learn lessons? And if the next global crisis is a climate one? It can be. I'm not sure. There are many institutions saying, predicting, the next global crisis is a climate one. And do you think the world will still have the same Security Council that is a photo of 1946? Just pay attention to the Security Council photo. That was the world of 24 of October 1945, the day United Nations were founded. That photo is a very relevant photo, but it is historical. Those are the winners of the Second World War. But sorry, you don't have India as a permanent member of Security Council, the largest populated country in the world, 1.4 billion people. Sorry, you don't have Japan which is the third economy of the world. You don't have Germany, the first economy of Europe. You don't have Brazil, which is almost a continent. That world of the classic organization of United Nations is outdated and is deadlocked. Don't ask Russia and its veto right if they condemn the aggression of Ukraine. Okay? The third thing I want to remark with you is to share with you is about some ideas about the bio and technological evolution of the threats we have to consider. And again, COVID is very different from the war in Ukraine, but in both scenarios, you had some troubling, you're living, you're seeing, you're witnessing some troubling technological or biological evolutions. And if you read the new strategic concept of NATO, you will understand that in the mindset of NATO, the nature of weapons are also changed, changing. The first thing I would, this my first remark is strongly critic with consultants. I'm a consultant, so it's self-critical. Consultancy, enterprises, international think tanks, and multilateral organization. Tell me one international advisory report that listed a pandemic as a major risk in this world. Last time was in 2008, and it was the World Economic Forum. You had the Asian flu, and then I think it was in force in the rank, you had epidemic or pandemic phenomena. After 2008, nobody listened more about pandemic threats. Suddenly, in 2020, you had COVID-19. And tell me one international report where invasion of Ukraine by Russia was considered probable. Zero. So we have to be a little bit more accurate on our strategic thinking. To have more critical spirit, not repeating always the same things. Okay, I believe climate change is a huge challenge, but I don't believe the five major risks of the world are all related with climate. Sorry, we have other problems on poverty, on peace, on freedom or lack of freedom, etc., etc., etc. What was, as you know, in the beginning of the COVID crisis, there was obviously lack of transparency. This is common sense today. So. I don't believe in conspirative theories, so just to share. I'm sufficiently rational to avoid conspirative theories that I know they are very popular. So I don't think someone in China invented the virus to make that, to damage the world. There is no evidence about this conspirational theory. Both presidents of the United States, Trump and Biden, asked intelligence community the largest evidence they could find, and none was even a little bit condescending with the conspirational theories. But there is possibly that the major explanation of COVID was an animal source transmitted to human beings. But there is a possible second explanation, which was the so-called lab leak. I mean, an accident. And my reflection, an accident in the lab one, namely, and what I want to share with you, because this is really a matter of security, you have 59 labs in the world devoted to biological research, namely virus. And I say 59, high level security 4, which is the maximum level. You have high security 1, 2, 3, 4. 4, it's the top level. You have many in Asia and many in Americas, and there is enough evidence that a part of these labs are not compliant with security protocols. And that is a risk. Virus manipulation is obviously a risk if it's not done in totally safe conditions. So the mere possibility, I'm not mentioning probability, remember the mission of WHO, then the opinions, individual opinions of the members of the mission, then the interviews of the president of the mission. There was a division. They didn't exclude the possibility of an accident. There was one in the past in China, in Beijing, in another lab 15 years ago, or some years, 16 years ago, I think. But this is, you know, how the world reached a considerable degree of transparency, control, and vigilance, for instance, on atomic energy. We should have the same level. I'm a true believer in the International Atomic Energy Agency. They are extremely relevant in nuclear agreements. They are vigilant. They have very good human resources, very good scientists working with them. We should have the same level of vigilance on biological high security labs, at least, if we want to be preventive, okay, and not merely reactive. The rest, and I'm finishing, you know, I think, every day on your daily life. Also, war is, Navy is still the Navy, Air Force is still the Air Force, and by the way, thanks to the Portuguese militaries from the Portuguese Air Force helping this seminar. And the Army is still the Army, but you have a force branch. Data, cyber, crypto. You will get used more and more. If you just check the number of crypto attacks, or cyber crime, or data control threats, you will understand that it is, you will have to face in your generation and in the generation of your children a much more immaterial threat, but lethal as other threats, okay? Just remember what happened to the colonial pipeline in the east coast of the United States of America last year. 45% of the coast without energy from one day to another by a cyber attack, a cyber disruption. I will share with you to finish what the former, a fantastic mind, a former director of MI6. Once I had a conversation with him, and he told me, please note the differences between cyber war and classic war. Because your generation, you will witness, yes, some examples of classic war, but more and more cyber war. And the first difference is, in classic war, you know something about your enemy. In cyber war, your enemy knows everything about you, and you just know nothing about him. First difference. Second difference. Classic war has territory, a perimeter. Okay, it's Dunkirk, it's the battle of the line of Maginot, the Maginot line, it's Waterloo, whatever. The cyber territory is the planet. It's not a fixed territory. The third thing is in the classic war, you know why. By national interests, by ideological reasons. In cyber war, you just don't know why. And you will take some time to understand why. Maybe a girl or a boy of 20 years old just wants to create chaos. It's much more frequent than you think. The will of chaos creations. It's very linked to the digital society. And by the way, if I may advise you something, okay, internet is very good. Social media, it's interesting, but take care. Don't believe everything you read. Take care. Don't lose your axe. Keep the capacity of instinctively, immediately distinguish good and bad. Don't lose that axe. But okay, coming back to the third and last reason I want to share about this difference between cyber war and the classic war is, in the classic war, you had winners and losers. You have so many winners and so many losers that you see the Security Council in 2022, the winners of 1946. In cyber war, even if you have a counter hacker or an ethical hacker, which is a very bizarre name, okay, even if you can defeat your hacker, he will tell you, till tomorrow. I'm back tomorrow. So there are no definitive victories in the cyber war. So it's not, the question is not to build capacities for one moment, for one shot. No, it's a permanent threat, okay? This said, remark is back to bed. In many moments, we distrust, we are sad, sometimes upset with our Western democracies. They are not living the best moments, as we all know. But don't forget, at least there is a big difference. Freedom of speech. We can think, we can talk, we can say, we can write. Don't forget that in our continent, hundreds of millions of people have no that right. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Paul Portas. Somehow you covered all the topics, all the themes that we are developing in our summer seminar. So thank you so much. Fortunately, we are already used to your wisdom, knowledge, and expertise. Now I will pass the floor to someone who we respect a lot in the Portuguese Atlantic Committee and also in IATA Portugal, and for being a friend of all of us, of our IATA family, Miguel Ferreira da Silva, who was born in Porto in 1972. Miguel is a researcher, academic, and specialist in security, intelligence, and international affairs. He graduated from the Faculty of Law, University of Lisbon, and received his doctorate from the University of Nottingham, with a thesis on the legitimating discourse of the ad hoc international criminal tribunals. International Criminal Ad Hoc Tribunals, he completed postgraduate studies in political science and international relations at the Institute of Political Studies, and specializations in counterterrorism, as well as security and intelligence and government executive leadership at Georgetown University. Besides being a lecturer at the University of Nottingham at the Lusophone University, Miguel worked at the Defense Strategic Intelligence Service. He was the representative of the Ministry of National Defense at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C., where he also served as political attaché at the Portuguese Embassy in the United States. Miguel was director of the Commission for Study and Strategy of Governance of the Environment and founder of the European Institute of Strategic Governance. A regular speaker, trainer, and commentator on issues of strategy, security, and information, Miguel Ferreira da Silva was also the first president of the Portuguese Liberal Party. Miguel, once again, it's an honor to be with you here, once again in an initiative promoted by IATA Portugal. Maybe we could focus a little on the topic, on today's topic, biological wars and pandemics. I think that we all agree that no one could expect the pandemic that we lived, and we are still living, but we lived 2 years ago. I would ask you, Miguel, if you think that we have learned from the lessons of the past during this pandemic crisis, and if today we are prepared to face a new pandemic or even something that could be even more dangerous, biological war, this in a moment in which we are living in a more unpredictable world, given also the war that not just Ukraine, but all of us are living in Europe. Thank you so much once again. Miguel, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Manuel. With your permission, I'd like to thank first and foremost Mr. João Rebelo, the chairman of the Portuguese Atlantic Commission, and you, obviously, my dear Manuel Matos de Santos, the chairman of IATA Portugal, of the Youth Atlantic Treaty Association, but also, for several reasons, Mr. Paulo Portas, who is a reference for all of us here in Portugal, both in politics and in strategic thinking, and in defense, and in international relations. But for me, particularly, because the first time I was nominated to represent my country abroad, it was with your signature, sir, that it happened. So thank you very much once again. Having said this, the general topic is how to act. Pandemics, biological wars, how to act. Unlike Mr. Paulo Portas, I am not concerned at all with the 50-something labs around the world, for one very specific reason. Because for $300-something, I can buy CRISP technology to manipulate DNA, and in my garage, manipulate viruses. What's the ... is to have access to the proper DNA. It's pretty much like, and in this we are together, the control that happens today regarding nuclear energy and weapons, so the two faces, the civilian and the defense or the war use of nuclear material, is today controlled. The same does not happen regarding biological threats and assets. That, in that particular regard, we agree. An international organization that has the power to control access, that is needed. But the technology itself, my dear fellows, it's out in the street, it's $300, anyone here can buy it. So that door is already closed, wide open. Actually, it's a gate. But I'd say something else. With probably the two exceptions of the Lieutenant Colonel and the Captain, thank you both for your service to our country and to the Alliance, obviously, from us all. Our main goal when we think about pandemics and biological war should not, I repeat, should not be a security concern, should not be a defense concern. As some of you heard in a prior meeting that we had with IATA a few months back in Portuguese, I said that and I'm saying it here again. By far the biggest challenge, it's a political one, not a defense one. And I'll say why. Yes, we all know that the former USSR was developing a Marburg viral weapon. Yes, we all know that Japan used in the Second World War biological weapons in China, blah, blah, and so many other cases known and not so well known. But the biological, or better said, the bio-warfare, not as the title, biological wars. Because biological wars implies that the full scope of a specific war is biological. That does not happen, except with one actor. And that actor is Mother Nature. We will not control her. We will not control her. Every other actor will not engage in a biological war on itself, meaning contained as only a biological war. It will have to be part of something else. It will be an effort within biological warfare, but in a political context of a war waged in several dimensions, as you said, and very well, cyber, but also classic, probably nuclear, probably chemical, and so on and so forth. So, bear in mind, in my view and in my analysis, there's no such thing as a biological war, contained as such. There is bio-warfare. And in bio-warfare, what we imagine and what real-life cases of bio-warfare exist, there's a huge difference. We imagine the end of the world. We imagine an attack that destroys completely a society. Up until now, yes, reality sometimes surpasses every imagination, but up until now, the natural outbreaks have been far, but far worse than any biological biowarfare that man has either invented or deployed. Again, up until now. Why? I will answer this question, but to be honest, it doesn't matter what I answer or what any of you, with the exception of the Lieutenant Colonel and the Captain, will answer, and I'll tell you why. We have to trust military planning. This is an answer that should be given by the military. We should be concerned with something else, with the political level, and I'll get there. Yes, there is international law that theoretically contains biowarfare development, even though, as I just said a while ago, the technology is out there in the street. But the main reason for attacks, for biowarfare attacks, to be much more contained than natural outbreaks is, in my analysis, one. Is to answer the question, are we in war? Are we in war? Because if we, as a society, as a democratic rule of law society, understand an attack by a foreign enemy, whatever foreign may mean, by an enemy, then we will allow our civil liberties, our rule of law, our constitutional rights, to be compressed in a very specific case in time and geographically so as to respond and to minimize that attack. The same is impossible in a natural outbreak. You see the point here? Yes, we have the avian influenza back in 1997. Yes, we have SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, back in 2003, Yes, we had H1N1 in 2009. Yes, we now have COVID, with almost reaching 6.5 million deaths worldwide. Almost. In all these cases, the degree of destruction, both in human lives and in economic and social development, have been far, far, far greater than any possible attack or incident regarding biowarfare. Changing just slightly my discourse, we all know or heard about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. There is a slight difference between the Old and New Testament. One of them has a different name, but we all vaguely know that it's war, death, famine, and plague. With, again, there is a tiny detail, but we'll not go into that now because we all use this. What you usually don't relate is with the Serengeti rules on population control, on animal, natural population control. Any given animal population follows the Serengeti rules of population control, whereby, oh my, also for predators, pathogens, parasites, and food supply, it's too far, I'm sorry, and food supply control the population of any given animal community. So, if you think war, death, famine, and plague, we, the human population, that, as we know, far outseed the natural dimension of a human population vis-à-vis the environment that we live in, we have conquered most of them, or at least controlled them, or at least postponed them, be it death with a larger life expectation, from generation to generation, actually it's less than a generation. We have, up to a point, controlled famine as a global threat. We haven't in specific regions, but today, as we know, as a global community, we produce more than enough food for the population. There is a problem in distributing that food. But the production point we have surpassed, so we are above what nature would do with any animal population. We have, again, postponed death, we have more or less in our society controlled up to a point war, at least in the last century, well, less than a century, but from the 40s onwards.
70 years.
Yeah. I'm pushing to try to see if we go to the century, but yeah, not yet. Anyways. We have not controlled plagues. Yes, we have. The vast majority of plagues that would wipe out a significant number of the population, which would be a natural control, the most recent one, the Spanish influenza, in the beginning of last century. We've controlled most of them, TB, even HIV, and so on and so forth, even though they still kill quite a large number of people, they are more or less contained, or at least controlled, or at least, from a defense perspective, mitigated. What we don't think about is that mosquitoes, of all animals, mosquitoes kill millions of humans every year, far more than the next animal, which are, I believe, crocodiles, with less than 1,000, by the way, worldwide, 1,000 deaths, human deaths. But mosquitoes still today, directly and indirectly, are vectors of plagues, in a wider sense of the word, that still kill millions. However, we have controlled the Black Death that wiped out a third of the European population. We have controlled, up to a point, smallpox, which wiped out, in some communities, 80 to 90% of indigenous populations. We have controlled TB, tuberculosis. However, 4 years ago, 2018, TB still killed 1.5 million people worldwide. even though it's controlled. See the point here? The point is, it is not an issue in itself as a threat, in my view, in my assessment, to consider pandemics, or for that matter, biowarfare, which is the dwarf vis-à-vis the natural causes of pandemics, as a threat, dwarf as a threat. That is not the main issue that we should be debating here. The how to act should be split in two very different areas. And to introduce this last part of my intervention, which I hope is as short as possible, let me read you a very short paragraph from an article published 2 years ago. It said back on May 7th, 2020, in a Portuguese media, part of an article, and the author said about NATO, more than a union of countries that aims at their mutual defense, creating consensus and peace amongst themselves, NATO was based on the definition of a very assertive ideology. Ideology. The uncompromising defense of the values of democracy and freedom. This very simple statement is much deeper than it seems. By the way, thank you very much to the author who is sitting right next to me. It was Manuel, who wrote in a Portuguese newspaper a couple of years ago. And he was absolutely right. If we look at this last, better known pandemic of COVID-19, NATO was not a major actor. Why? Why was it not a major actor? It had the resources. And the answer, again, in my modest opinion, is one. It was a political problem. If we look around this room, most of us are civilian. And we do not take seriously our role in NATO, our political role to support NATO, to support in the wider society, to support it in political parties, to support it within our families. That is why NATO is so shy. Because our men and women in uniform, when they are called to a mission, be it to stop military advances from other countries outside NATO, or be it to distribute vaccines throughout the members, they are ready. They never say no. And they can do planning. If we trust them to do this, and in Portugal it happened because we had an admiral actually taking care of the vaccination process to the civilian population, and it worked wonderfully, regardless of political ideas about what happened next to his career, but that's a whole different matter. The point is, the military planning of how to deal with a threat, be it by nature or by another actor, we can trust our military. We can trust our alliance. But those military, that alliance, does not have the political weight to come out and take a role in civilian defense. That, in my view, my friends, is your task. Not, well, maybe yours too, but I'm sorry, guys, but not so much ours. We've been there than that, now it's their turn. So my challenge to you is the answer to how to act is to understand why do we need defense. We, NATO, not other countries. Why do we need defense? Why do we need security? Because, as Manuel said, NATO was based on the definition of a very assertive ideology. The uncompromising defense of the values of democracy and freedom. So let's assume this. Let's say that, unlike other systems, Parenthesis. You know that democracy is not efficient, right? And you know why? The most efficient way of governing a country is a dictatorship, because it's efficient. You see what you want, you take a decision, and it's executed in the good sense of the word, executing a policy, a public policy. That's efficiency. No. Those are results, result-driven action, without other things. The other things, it's our freedom. It's different to political opinions. It's being able to express those opinions. It's being able to be in parliament representing those opinions. So, if we want to preserve those freedoms, we have to have the courage to resist an excess of efficiency, even in pandemics and especially in biowarfare. That part, that operational part, we should trust our military. They have proven for many, many, many years now that they are trustworthy, and they are democratic, and they do not engage in politics. We can rest assured. But they need our support. They need us to stand up politically and say, what do we want to do with threats of pandemics, so natural causes, and biowarfare? And now, reaching almost the end, here goes the bomb. The bomb is what we all lived in these past 2 years made us numb. We are numb to an excess of power. We are numb to resist a political power that, with the cape of protecting us, with the cape of a health emergency, has extra powers to act, claiming, for instance, here in our country, we are in the way of approving a law of health emergency. Does it make sense? Yes, but in the same sense that it would make in 2018 or 2019. Because why do we want to protect our citizens if we are taking out the liberty? Okay, I'm a liberal, so in my view, this is very obvious, but I'll have to state it. It's better to live one day of freedom than a lifetime in slavery. Yes, it may make sense to have containment of a natural threat, but that containment cannot ever put in question a democracy, the rule of law, and my liberties. Because if it does, why shouldn't I die? It's probably better to die than to live as a slave. Yes, I'm putting a little bit of blood and color in the full presentation, because I don't want to take much of your time. But the main point here is, let us separate the two questions. These type of threats, be it natural, pandemics, really serious, or be it warfare, yeah, it's serious, but it's politics as usual, it's arms race as usual, just a different type, NBQR and so on and so forth. We've all been there than that, we just haven't lived it in our home. But conceptually, it's the same thing. The two things are different lines of action. How to act in the response, it's a planning issue. And we have the military to do it. If we allow them to share with us in civilian defense, and not just in defense, traditional defense, their capabilities so as to contain that threat. Another completely different thing is to give our governments the power to, with that excuse, curtail our civil liberties. That is the real danger in my view. So how to act? Give to the military the planning and stand up for your rights, because health, as any other issue, as education, as housing, as any other issue, is not important enough for us to stop being in a rule of law, democratic abiding society that is the ideology of NATO. That is why we exist, to defend democracy, freedom and the rule of law.
Thank you so much, Miguel. Thank you so much, Miguel, for your outstanding remarks, and not for analyzing NATO's strategic concept, but for your own strategic concept and for presenting it to us. So now, if you allow me, in this year's edition, we have a group of quality with us, our participants that are coming from Algeria, France, Georgia, Germany, Hungary, Iceland, Mexico, Morocco, Norway, Portugal, Slovakia, Spain, and Turkey. And I hope I didn't forget anyone. I don't think so. Thank you once again for Estonia, Vanessa, our Vice President of IATA International Board. Sorry, Vanessa. It was not necessary to say it. I think that we deserve some questions from you, and also to take advantage of
started
having
Estonia.
Starting now, yes, now it has to be, and also by taking advantage of the presence of Mr. Paulo Portas and Mr. Miguel Ferreira da Silva to share their ideas with you and to help us all. So, the first question goes to Vanessa. Estonia, Vanessa, if she, where is Vanessa? Vanessa, no. Do you want to make a question or do you want to?
Please open the micro. Mm-hmm.
Estonia.
Thank you. Thank you so much. My name is Vanessa and I'm from Estonia. And our group is working also on the new threats and challenges. And if we speak about technology, then this question we have also been asked as we are gathering this material for our policy paper as well. But in your opinion, what is the technology that you are most concerned about, of which the developments might cause some serious security concerns and issues? Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Vanessa. The next one?
It's two and two.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. The next one, Miguel Moreira from Portugal.
Thank you for the both presentations. Firstly, I have to say it is an honor to be with our ex-Vice Prime Minister in one of the hardest phases, maybe, after 25 April of 74 of Portugal, that it was the crisis in 2010. I would like to ask two questions to both orators. What other strategies should the European Union adopt to be more effective in dealing with Russia and other powers like as China? And what is the difference between negotiation with Russia or negotiation with other suspect countries that we are negotiating now? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Miguel. And the last one, please, goes to maybe, yeah, just to have a different country, okay.
Just grow close, because the acoustic, this room is very beautiful, but it's not, it was not fitted for micros, okay? So
if you allow me
I didn't understand the last part of your question, Miguel. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to repeat it, Miguel?
All the question that it is, what is the difference between negotiation with Russia or negotiation like we are doing now with other suspect countries that put in cause sometimes the human rights and the other basic rights that Occidental values. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Miguel. And now we can have two last questions by Clara from Spain, and also then from Rafaela from Portugal. Clara, go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you so much for the conference. I wanted to ask you regarding to global health governance, basically how it works and how should it look, because there's this consensus that we don't have a current global health governance, and what should the path look like in that aspect?
Muchas gracias, Clara. Rafaela?
I come from Povo de Varzim. It's an honor, especially to be here, but after these amazing presentations by Mr. Paulo Portas and Mr. Miguel Ferreira da Silva, they were very in-depth, so it was, I think I speak on behalf of everyone by saying that it was amazing to hear and to learn more about it. This morning, actually, I participated in a panel and I talked a little bit of two emerging new threats that I believe are the present and the future concern of NATO and of the international community, especially weaponization of migrants and the weaponization of technology, namely the lethal autonomous weapon systems. Unfortunately, I think NATO is focusing merely on the debate around the conceptualization. And when it comes to conceptualization, we saw the difficult process in terms of the concept and the notion of terrorism. And we saw that it was vague enough for in order to lead to a misleading and to a confusion when it comes to practicality. So I would like you to ask you both, what do you think it would be better to do? So should NATO allies focus on reviewing and writing a report or a convention on these two specific topics and other ones that are related to new emerging threats? Or should we focus on trying to arrange and work on common protocols and common agreements that have more practical and reality influence. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rafaela. So I think that for both of you, it will be easy to answer at once. So who wants to start?
Thank you. First, what is the technology I fear more? The question is from Estonia.
Yes.
I want to share with you, I admire your country and I would love our public administration to be so efficient and digitalized as yours is. So you have the reputation of having the best digital administration in the world. Keep that reputation and share technology, please, okay? And first of all, second, what I fear more, I will advise you a little book from a man, an intellectual, an academic with 99 years old, Henry Kissinger, one of the best thinkers of the Western world. He is a realist, okay? And he wrote a book during the pandemic with the former Google CEO and the MIT chairman of innovation, because he wanted to understand what was the state of the art on artificial intelligence. Can you imagine if someone of us will reach 99 years? At 99, you still want to learn, to understand, and to write, and to share. It's unbelievable. Please read that book, and you will understand my answer. I know that almost all interesting things in the world are like that. I have many hopes on artificial intelligence on one side, but I fear on the other side. I just let you with a little experience from MIT scientists to a robo ruled by artificial intelligence. In a moment, they were starting a dialogue. And the scientists asked the robot Do you have morals? And the answer of the robot was, no, but I can avoid your question. So, if you ask me, the technology, I know where it starts, but I don't know where it ends, artificial intelligence, okay? So, this is my answer. The second one is on Miguel. You know, I have a peculiar theory about negotiation in the war that Russia started in Ukraine. You have basically four players: Russia, Ukraine, United States, and China. And then you could have a fifth player, Europe, but Europe is so dependent on energy and so dependent on defense that in a way it's not an autonomous player. I would say that you will reach negotiation table when three of these four will be favorable to a negotiation, or with a disposition to a negotiation, okay? In this moment, you have none, zero. None of the four are close of a negotiation will, if we understand what they want, okay? So we are far from that. The Russians, because they didn't conquest, they have not enough territory in their hands. They still want the south. The Ukrainians, because the progressive parity of forces give them hope to reverse a great reversal of the military situation. The Americans, because they are directly financing and weaponizing Ukraine against Russia, and China, because they still want to wait a little bit because it's easy to understand if they have some pleasure in the decline of the Western world, okay? But this said, so four players, at least three must be favorable to a negotiation and force the fourth. But for the moment, I think we are far from it. We are not negotiating, if I remember well, Miguel, we are not negotiating. I'm a realistic. I don't reduce the principle of negotiation to democracies. Because if I reduce the principle of negotiation to democracies, I will reduce my relations to one third or something like that in the world. But I'm not, you don't have in the current moment a country like Russia. You cannot compare with other, because it's not only an authoritarian state or a totalitarian state. And by the way, for 1,000 years. Okay, if you just try to understand how many years of democracy Russia had, maybe the fingers of one hand are enough. And I'm being optimistic. Okay, so. Russia is not only a dictator, but he is the aggressor of a sovereign country. So we are not negotiating with aggressors, invaders of different countries. So the Russian case is different. I understand your question, but it's different. We'll have to sit with them in the negotiation table, but I let you with one question. Will you believe one word from Putin? When you know, trust is the most difficult thing to build and the easiest thing to destroy. Pay attention to what happened Friday with the cereals agreement. And finally, just I would be very pragmatic, Rafaela. I would use both. We need a strong update of many international conventions that are not updated to, even WTO, even the trade organization is not fitted for services. So it's not technology, it's services, just services. So we are lost in translation, as Sofia Coppola would in title, okay? We need to update seriously many international conventions. And by the way, you live in a world with more and more, how could I say, more and more non-institutionalized and not mandatory coherent alliances. You will have much more specific alliances. AUKUS, the Five Eyes, the Quad, you will have the world seen by Russia. You will have much more flexible and multiple alliances. They are not bilateral, they are not exactly multilateral, but they are one of the consequences of a weak international system. Okay? So, and para, ¿tú cómo te llamas? Clara, yo como soy medio español, te digo una, pues un saludo muy especial. ¿Eh? ¿Y tú dónde vienes? ¿De qué región de España vienes? De Madrid, madrileña, pura, bueno. De Castilla. Sí, bueno. Bueno, el camino, the way to, the path to real global governance is, in my opinion, the main question. Okay. I love globalization. Globalization was the best revolution, not being a revolution, in the world. Never in our economic history the reduction of extreme poverty was the reduction reached by globalization till 2015. Globalization is a liberal phenomenon. It's much better than any revolution that suggests you a new world tomorrow morning. Okay? There are 900 million people out of extreme poverty and poverty due to globalization, and that is a better morning, okay? Much better than ideology. And but you cannot live in such a global world with such an interdependence without a minimum of global governance. So the only possibility, is to update international institutions, okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Papadopoulos. Miguel, please.
Thank you very much. Most of the questions have already been answered, so thank you so much to both the questions and the answers that Mr. Papadopoulos kindly suggested. So I'll add just a couple of things here and there. I tend to agree that artificial intelligence is the It's hard to choose the words. It's really hard. It's the single largest threat to the survival of the human race. However, because death doesn't scare me in the sense that it's part of life, we are all going to die. You know that, right? It's a question of time. If it happens and if I'm dead, there's no point in worrying on the afterlife in the political context. In the private belief realm, yes, of course. But this to say, in life, in social life as we know it, from tech, I'm much more concerned with dependencies than subjugation.
Than
subjugation. Okay. Meaning, if I'm dependent from technology to exert my choices, that limits my being, my freedom as a single entity. If I'm subjugated, if I become some sort of slave, there is no point at all. It's a barrier, even though it's worst, there's nothing to do, you see my point? So yes, artificial intelligence, as the single largest threat to the survival of the human race as we know it, at least from the society, from a human race within society, because it's possible to think, never mind, you know what I mean, matrix and so on. But the point is, very simple choices that you make on a daily basis, if they become dependent on technology, that, just like I said about pandemics, that is a political risk to our shared ideology of democracy and freedom. That scares me a lot. Having said that, Miguel, Mr. Paulo Portas answered already brilliantly, but I would say that the largest difference in negotiating with Russia is that they have us by the pipeline. That's what I meant. You see my point? Which again comes back to the political power of the European Union and the role of the European Union within NATO. Most of us have a lot of reservations on the presidency of Mr. Trump. But I tend to say that no president, no politician, no human, none of us is completely bad or completely good. We have at least one or two cases of inspiration.
Except North Korea.
Fortunately, I don't know it because it's dark, especially at night. But yeah, but you see the point. Putting the finger in the fact that the European Union does not contribute to NATO enough was seen as offensive back at the time, in the beginning of the presidency. But today, I tend to feel that we, this side of the pond, actually have some pride in contributing a little bit more.
Yeah.
And that is good. What's the problem in that? So again, a political issue, see, of support to our role. It's interesting to see how that plays out in the way in which the European Union assumes its seat at the table of those negotiations. Going to Clara. Clara, again, Mr. Paulo Portas already answered. And if I would add just a tiny thing, it scares me a lot to think about health governance worldwide. Because it's literally Big Brother. It's actually worse than that. It's I'm missing the English expression to Admirável Mundo Novo, Aldous Huxley. Brave New World. It's Brave New World, you know. It's biologically controlling a society. And for that reason, I actually took the time to be very, to look for it, to be very precise. We both are from Romance languages, Castellano y Portugués, but in English, the difference, the thin difference between effective and efficient makes all the difference in international governance. I do want a system that is effective in controlling a pandemic, but I do not want the most efficient system, which is total political control. See the point? So it scares me. And in that regard, let me point out what I haven't said, and it's my message to the world. There is a tradition in Europe, in continental Europe, of having programmatic constitutions. We write down in our constitutions, health for all, education for all, housing for all. These are very good intentions. I adhere and support those intentions. I oppose them being in the Constitution. Why? If you look at the oldest written Constitution still in place, United States, you see that it's still operational because the Founding Fathers focused on when it goes wrong, what should we do? And so checks and balances, and not in being programmatic. When things are good, when things are going well in a democratic system, each government, in their case, Democratic Party or Republican Party, will have an electoral program that will win and will support more or less housing, more or less education, more or less whatever. So the Constitution is thought on when it goes wrong, which are the checks and balances? And we, European, tend to be very programmatic. And when the problems arise, when the fan, we lack checks and balances because we haven't thought about it. We haven't thought in the worst case scenario. We are all very aspirational. We all want to conduct our societies into heaven. Hey, we live on Earth. Let's deal when it goes bad. So my answer would be international governance, checks and balances, and more checks and balances. If we have to give them power, it's a very specific power to be effective, but never efficient. Please, I want mistakes. I want democracy. Last but not least, Rafaela, I tend to agree completely with what Mr. Paul Portas said. There's really, honestly, not so much to say, with one tiny note. Migrants. We have, again, as Mr. Paul Portas, and I'll end, I swear I'll end in 1 minute. As Mr. Paul Portas just said, we have a system, an international system, that was designed in the previous century with minds from the previous century. It's time to update. The concept of a nation and of a state evolved. I am from a country, as you are, one of the few countries in the world that has one people, one nation, one state. It's very uncommon. For us, it's normal, but it's very uncommon. Maybe it's time for us all to consider that migrants are not necessarily from this or that country. They are migrants, just human beings. If they become migrants, well, mind you said migrants, not refugees, which are completely different, okay? Refugees is one thing, we must protect and so on and so forth. But migrants are in themselves a resource in the sense that we all human beings are a resource to our communities. So maybe it's time to start thinking not about in national terms of talking between countries. If you know what I mean, I'm trying not to say the names of the specific countries around the Mediterranean. And to think about the people and the opportunities and our investments maybe in their original countries. And you know what I mean, right? It's better not to actually there.
Thank you, Miguel. This was fantastic. Let's have a huge round of applause to Mr. Paul Portas and Mr. Miguel Ferreira da Silva. Thank you. And now I will ask you a group photo, all of us, participants, our team, with Mr. Paul Portas and Mr. Miguel Ferreira da Silva. Please join us. Thank you.